Catskill. From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. This is my first time back on air since we wrapped up the summer fun drive on Friday evening. So big thanks to Patricio Rabayo for filling in for me here the last couple days. And even bigger thanks to everyone who stepped up and stood tall in our time of need at the end of the fun drive. Thank you so much for what... Thank you for making what could have been a really horrible day or two for us immediately after we learned that Congress is going to defund us. Thank you for making that not just bearable, but it was like almost like a celebration. The donations, the calls, the comments, it truly was an outpouring of financial, intellectual, and emotional support, and it really, at least on my end, made everything better. It made my 10-hour marathon on air Friday a fabulous experience. So thank you so much, everyone. And of course, that really was just the very beginning of our brand new time of need, and that time persists, so you can and should still donate at wjffradio.org. Now let's get to the news now, because advocates in New York State are calling for changes to its felony murder law. Coming up in the second half of the show, Genevieve Hartnett talks to the Prison Brain Trust about why they feel the current law negatively impacts people of color. And at the end of the show, I'll also have an update for you on the Catskill Fly Fishing Center and Museum in Livingston Manor, because not only are they lifting their ban on dogs on their premises, but they're one of 9 Sullivan County museums participating in this coming museum weekend. We have all that coming up. But first, let's continue our coverage of how the Trump administration's broader cuts to funding are impacting local communities. Garnet Health is saying the cuts to Medicaid could be the last straw for the rural hospital. Tim Bruno has that interview in a moment, but first, funding cuts that could hurt our ability to respond to an emergency. Disaster and emergency preparedness response in New York and across the country could be at a crossroads, with the Trump administration withholding more than $2 billion of counterterrorism and homeland security funds this year, including more than $250 million to the Empire State. New York State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Services Commissioner Jackie Bray talked with Public Radio's David Lombardo on the Capitol Press Room about what could be coming next from Washington, D.C.
Well, I want to turn to FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, more broadly. Yeah. The president has indicated that he thinks it should be eliminated. Is there a version of disaster response that you think makes sense without FEMA?
So one of the most important things that FEMA does, in addition to the resources that they're able to provide, is they provide a singular system of operating and coordination across jurisdictions. There are events every single year that require multiple states to respond. Obviously, the devastating, gut-wrenching floods in Texas, many states sent teams in, recovery teams, response teams in. There are disasters every year that require multiple jurisdictions to work together, even when you don't talk about across states, when you just talk about counties coordinating or us coordinating with New York City. And the language, the systems, the standard operating procedures are all organized and created by FEMA. All of the training we give to make sure that if you show up at an emergency operations center, you know what you're doing, you know how to plug in, is all training that FEMA sets the standards for. It might take years, but it will, our capacity to help each other, our capacity to show up in times of crisis, Erie County sending teams to Onondaga County to help, or Nassau County needing support from New York City, all of that will start to break down without a federal emergency management role. Are there things I would change about FEMA? Yeah, overnight, tomorrow. Let me at it.
Yeah, what would you want to change?
Oh, I mean, the bureaucratic process for claiming, sort of pulling down the reimbursement money. I mean, we are still paying on disasters that happened 10 years ago because of how many hoops we jump through. So sort of reducing those, certainly. How easy it is to not just build back, but to build back better. If I've got a bridge that washes out in one hurricane, why am I building the same bridge again? Right here in New York, in Steuben County, the remnants of Fred wiped out infrastructure. 3 years later, the remnants of Debbie Beryl, I'm going to get which storm wrong from last year, did exactly the same thing. So, for example, the school in Fred, got the high school, got completely flooded and wiped out. We fought with FEMA for 3 years to get permission to not just rebuild that school, but to move the school. Why are we letting the school stay near that river? We didn't get it until the second storm came through and flooded that school and wiped out that school again. So are there things I would change? Absolutely. But I wouldn't say we need to reduce the federal role in emergency management or the federal role in disaster recovery. I would say we need to work together to make things work better.
And that's State Homeland Security Emergency Services Commissioner Jackie Bray speaking with WCNY's David Lombardo yesterday on the Capitol Press Room. Thank you to the New York Public News Network for that. Continuing with the impacts of federal funding cuts here in Sullivan County, the CEO of Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, is warning that newly signed federal legislation could deal a severe blow to rural hospitals that are already on the financial brink. Jerry Dunleavy oversees Garnet Health's two Sullivan County campuses in Harris and Calicoon. Speaking live with Tim Bruno this morning on Radio Chatskill, he expressed concern about the sweeping Medicaid changes enacted as part of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. It was signed into law by President Trump on the 4th of July.
On a high level, what this bill does is it shifts a significant amount of the funding responsibility from the federal government to the state government with regard to the Medicaid program. And the concern that we have, and I think that is shared by others that sit in a similar position to me, is that the state is not going to be able to make up that difference. So they won't be able to cover the full cost of the Medicaid program. And that's going to cause significant challenges for our health systems, but particularly our rural hospitals. So, you know, we've been monitoring this bill since it was first introduced. We engaged in state advocacy efforts, spent time up in Albany, spent time in Washington, but unfortunately, we were not able to impact much change in what came out once the bill was signed into law. The reason why this is important for Sullivan County is about 35-40% of the patients that we serve are on Medicaid. An additional 35 or 40% because of our aging population is on Medicare. So that leaves 20%, and that 20% is sometimes self-pay, sometimes it's charity care. And there's a small amount of commercial insurance, but that payer mix is a recipe for, you know, barely being able to break even. And if you start to cut programs that fund the organization, it's going to be significant. You know, it's also important to note, you know, although the bill has been going through Congress for some time, the specifics really are still under review. So I think it's going to be a couple of weeks before we know the true financial impact. You know, as you mentioned in your introductory statement, about 1.5 million people in New York State are going to be impacted. And if you look at some of the information that's available by congressional district, I think for our district, they talk about 35,000-40,000 people could potentially lose their coverage. And a percentage of those are in Sullivan County.
And given that some of the details of this bill are not completely clear, as you mentioned, what are some of the biggest challenges to New York's rural hospitals from your perspective then? Is it that amount of folks who rely on Medicaid, and then how will this law impact those challenges? Again, with the backdrop of knowing not all the complete details yet.
Yeah, so most rural communities, and Sullivan County being one of them, as I mentioned, they have older populations, lower income population that is heavily dependent upon the Medicaid program. And although we don't know the specifics, we know that the Medicaid cuts are going to leave many people without insurance. There's also, you know, reduction of state appropriations for rural hospitals that really will further impact our financial performance. You know, we're concerned that this is going to force us to make decisions on services that we provide, and which services can we not sustain. And that's a terrible position to be in. you know, there's going to become this ripple effect, you know, where the loss of insurance, it's going to lead to those uninsured patients showing up in our emergency department, leaving, you know, providers and hospitals to cover that cost of care. So, you know, it's important to remember that hospitals do not and legally cannot turn anyone away who needs care. But at the same time, those hospitals really cannot support a growing volume of unreimbursed visits. So, you know, we'll see this impact more so in 2026 than in this year, but we know that it's coming.
What have you heard from your patients and employees about how they're feeling right now in this period of uncertainty?
Well, I actually, just this past Friday, I had an anniversary lunch. And this is a great opportunity where I'm able to hear from staff about, you know, what are their concerns. I talk with them about what's happening in the organization and, you know, what we're doing in the community. But when they had the opportunity to ask questions, it was heavily focused on the Medicaid cuts. And it's clearly top of mind. You know, we're very unique in Sullivan County. And I think rural organizations are unique in this way. We have an incredible connection, between our staff and our community. Many of our staff have been with the organization their entire career. We celebrated people that were with us for 1 year and up to 40 years during this luncheon. And, you know, they've seen a lot of financial turbulence over the years. I mean, healthcare is, you know, accustomed to change. I think we did a fantastic job of working our way through the pandemic. And, you know, staff understand that we work on a lean budget, and we've always managed our way through. And it's a combination of, you know, being very frugal. It's assistance from the state. It's enhanced Medicaid payments and some grants. That's what helps us as a rural hospital get through our operations. But the concern over the Medicaid cuts is just, you know, really, frankly, feels like the straw that broke the camel's back. And we're concerned about that. Mm-hmm. Our staff understand our community. They understand how many patients rely upon Medicaid. And they also understand the vulnerability of that population. They're oftentimes presenting with some significant medical complexity. So as a group of people that are highly, highly committed to our community, they're certainly concerned. With regard to patients, you know, it's interesting. You know, I've been watching this because of what I do for work. I've been watching this every day as it evolves. But I can't say that I've heard a lot from patients. And I don't spend all my time in my office. I'm out on the patient floors talking with staff, talking with patients in their rooms and also in the community. So the feedback from those folks hasn't been significant. I do think this is going to change as we get closer to 2026 and there's more of an understanding of what the impact is going to be. And, you know, if we have to make any changes in our service offerings, that certainly will catch the attention of our community.
And I mentioned as well that before this bill passed, rural hospitals, including Guardant Health, were facing some headwinds. Last month, the system announced some job cuts and restructuring moves, citing some tough choices brought in part by previous federal cuts. Now that this has passed, is there any risk of closure for any of the Guardant Health locations? Is that something you're concerned about? It's certainly something that seems to pop up in the community anytime something like this happens.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a health system that has a significant percentage of Medicaid patients that can't say they're concerned about having to look at service offerings. So, you know, the Medicaid cuts were most likely going to happen before those decisions were made. But, you know, we saw decrease in the Medicare program. There's a 2% increase is what we're slated for next year. We've seen reductions in the physician fee schedule. So what our doctors, what our employee doctors are paid for the care that they provide. And, you know, the two programs that were closed, specifically pulmonary rehab and diabetes, are two programs that I had direct oversight for many, many years in my career, and they deliver an excellent service, an important service. But the unfortunate consequence is that when programs can't support the cost of their operations, it presents hospital leaders with very, very difficult decisions. So, you know, there over years, you in a hospital, you will make you make money in some areas and you lose money in other areas, and hopefully, you know, at the end of the day, you come out even. But these federal cuts are going to make it more and more difficult to come out even.
How are you and the Garnet Health leadership team preparing to weather this storm?
We, as I said, we've been monitoring this all along. We normally have a strategic planning cycle that was set to start in mid-2026. We have decided as a leadership team that it's time for us to get together and start to talk about what are the strategic initiatives that we need to pursue in order to make our organization sustainable and in order to preserve as many of the services as we can that we currently provide. So I think that strategic planning effort will help create a vision and goals that will help us do the best we can to weather this storm. You know, these are unprecedented times. If you think about the past 5 years, 5 years ago, we were in the middle of a pandemic. We spent the years after trying to kind of regroup and go through some financial recovery. And now here we are facing billions of dollars of cuts to the Medicaid program. So it's a challenge, but we are committed to doing everything that we can to continue to serve the community.
Jerry Dunleavy is the CEO of Garnet Health Medical Center Catskills. He's responsible for the daily operations, oversight, and clinical support services of Garnet Health's two Sullivan County campuses located in Harris and Calicoon. More information at garnethealth.org. We should also note Garnet Health is a financial supporter of Radio Catskill. Mr. Dunleavy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you, Tim Bruno. Remember, you can hear Tim with local news and conversations live on Radio Catskill every weekday morning at 10.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
I'm Jason Dole. This is The Local Edition. In New York State, hundreds of individuals are currently incarcerated for second-degree murder, even if they were not at the scene of the crime or had no proven intention to commit the crime. It's all because of the state's felony murder law that can carry a maximum sentence of 25 to life. Prisoners Brain Trust, a multicultural coalition looking to end carceral harm, is working to repeal the felony murder law as well as uplift the writing and stories of incarcerated individuals through a monthly newsletter and social media campaign. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett spoke with co-founder Alicia Cohn and board member Natalie about how this law disproportionately affects young black and brown people and why implementing community-driven preventative policies is how we should be looking at ending crime nationwide.
Paris E. Whitfield, Devin Giordano, Brian Panarella, John Juca, Emmanuel Pierre. You may not know these names, but they are just five of the hundreds who are serving time in New York prisons and jails for wrongful murder convictions and are being highlighted by the Prisoners Brain Trust in their campaign to repeal New York's felony murder law.
So right now in New York State and in many other states, but we're here to talk about New York, there's this law in the books that's called the Felony Murder Law Doctrine that allows for an individual who can get charged with murder in the second degree, regardless if they were at the scene of the crime, regardless if they had any intent on killing a person, regardless of any factual information that's connecting to their crime, these persons should be convicted.
That was Alicia Cohn, co-founder of the Prisoners Brain Trust, a multicultural organization dedicated to ending carceral harm, organizing prisoners' voices, and shaping policy to create safe, healthy, thriving communities. As a formerly incarcerated person, Cohn used her understanding of violence in the carceral system to form the coalition towards repealing this law that has disproportionately affected Black, Brown, and low-income communities.
It is used by a catch-all by our district attorneys. It's used as a way to put a bunch of people in jail, right, that had connected, who was not even associated or at the scene of the crime, right? It doesn't actually put the people who are convicted for causing actual violence away into prison. And with this current law right now, and why our campaign particularly exists, the Faces of the Felony Murder Law campaign, is to show some of these, of what the system actually legally does, right? It legally takes the lives of so many individuals who had nothing to do with the crime, who had no intent of causing any type of bodily harm, had no intent of causing to actually being part of a crime or associated with it, but wind up in this catch-all from these district attorneys.
Rather than simply applying legislative pressure, Prisoners Brain Trust publishes a monthly newsletter, The Bulb, and uses their Instagram to highlight the stories and voices of those affected by the felony murder law, and to anyone who has been directly impacted by New York's carceral system. Natalie, a Prisoner's Brain Trust board member and the wife of Brian Panarella, who is serving time for a wrongful murder conviction, spoke about why hearing these voices is crucial in rethinking our concept of carcerality.
We give our members and everyone, even those that are not part of BBT, the chance to express themselves and voice themselves, because we believe that regardless of their situation, their voice deserves to be heard, right? Whether you're behind a wall or not. And I feel like it's important because we have to remember that these individuals are not animals, they're humans. And just because their freedom was taken away, it doesn't mean that their voice can't be heard. Their voice should be heard, because at the end of the day, they're the ones going through the prison systems. They're the ones going through physical violence. They're the ones that are going through also racism, because we have to be completely honest. There's a lot of racism within the system. And I think that we also help those, not just the ones that are incarcerated, but we try to have a community in where we try to help them integrate back into the community and for them to feel that they have the support that they need.
We highlight Paris, we highlight Brian, we highlight Devin Golden, Devin Hoare, and John, right? It's, we highlight all these individuals and they're part of our team. They're our leaders and they're in these spaces of what can we do to support them now and have the system, and where individuals are. Devin Hoare is 22 years old, was sentenced at 16 years old, 18 to life, right? These are life sentences where there's sadly, might not be a possibility that some of these individuals won't come home. And this law is their only chance to come home, where the actual people who did the murders, especially within Paris' case, they've been home for 8 years. Paris did not cause the murder. Paris is sitting on a 25-year life sentence waiting to go to the parole board and hope the parole board lets him out. And that's the case for Brian. That's the case for every single person, of where individuals who actually did the crime, take the plea deal, are sent home early, or sent home early, where the actual individual had nothing to do with it, or sitting in prison.
Excluding Hawaii and Kansas, 48 out of 50 states have a felony murder law. California and Missouri have passed bills to reform their versions of the law, and Pennsylvania and Massachusetts have reform bills in the works. However, Khan sees New York's implementation of the law as having a particular goal.
86% of individuals that are convicted under the felony murder law are Black and Brown. And what's particularly interesting, maybe for a lack of better words, harmful, is that New York has the highest rates of incarceration of youth with the felony murder law under the age of 25. That's how New York uses the felony murder law, right? And so when, and particularly with this law, is that district attorneys use it as a tool for plea bargaining. They push individuals for taking plea deals, to admitting guilt to a crime, because the courts and the sentences are stacked up against the individuals. We need to hold this government accountable. The government needs to be accountable. The prosecutors who we elect need to be held accountable for the simple fact that they need to do the investigation to prove not just somebody was particularly in the area or have been in the area earlier or lent out the car, but they knowingly and willingly and intently cause harm. And it allows for essentially our government not to have any accountability or allow for allow for this mass incarceration.
While Prisoners Brain Trust is working to repeal the felony murder law at the state level, census data shows that the highest number of those in New York prisons come from upstate counties, many of whom have not even faced trial yet.
When you have a to-life sentence as well, with possibility of parole, it doesn't matter how many, what you did to rehabilitate yourself or the changes you've done, right? It, at the end of the day, it's up to those judges on the parole board to decide if they want to let you out or if you'll be a good fit, right? So it's like, okay, so how much more rehabilitation can an individual do if you're still going to see what's written on paper and you're not going to see my accomplishments or how hard I have worked on to be able to be a better fit, not just for the community, but for yourself too, you know? So I feel like that's why this bill and this campaign is so important to not just PBT and all, obviously the faces of the campaign, but for everyone in the prison system that was charged with a felony murder.
Research has shown that crime is driven by poverty, lack of education, and limited job opportunities. And Alicia and Natalie see the repeal of this law as just one step towards community-led violence prevention.
We need to start thinking about what does it look like where sending someone to prison is not the first thing on someone's mind when someone causes harm. And it's about creating community care. It's about supporting each other, right? It's about looking, and what the Prisoners Brain Trust, you know, does, it looks into different individuals that are currently incarcerated, and they ask themselves, what is something that could have prevented me from whatever decisions they may or may not have made to winding up in prison? What are the different aspects of community care? Because once again, it goes back to the government not being held accountable if we start taking care of our community. And that's what our ultimate goal as an organization, as the felony murder law, yes, we want to repeal it, but also create community care, create these support services for mental health, for substance abuse, right? For the ways to actually people to make a living wage, right? To be able to be part of a society. And when individuals do cause harm, there's actual rehabilitation. We're not talking about letting people out of prison. We're not talking about opening the floodgates, right? Of like, okay, here, open up the doors. We are talking about actual like accountability, actual support of when people are coming home and showing some humanity.
Thank you so much for joining to talk to me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Genevieve, for that story. Finally, tonight, before we go, I have a little what's happening in our area news about local museums. And we're starting with an update on a story that I brought you a week ago, last Monday, actually. And that was when the Catskill Fly Fishing Center and Museum announced that no dogs would be allowed on its campus there in Livingston Manor due to an unfortunate incident involving an unleashed dog on their property. Well, today, in a message to supporters and notices on its website and on social media, the center said it was happily announcing dogs would again be allowed on site, but those dogs have to be on leashes. Their statement said, quote, "Please keep in mind that all dogs must be leashed at all times when on our property. This rule is a no-exceptions rule. We will have to ask you and your dog to leave should we see it being violated," end quote. Catskill Fly Fishing Center Museum's full updated dog walking policy is at their website, cffcm.com. And this is where I'd segue into the next announcement. I'd like to note that the Fly Fishing Center is one of nine museums participating in the big Sullivan County Museum Weekend happening this Saturday and Sunday. So here's a list of all the participating museums: Catskill Art Space, Catskill Fly Fishing Center Museum, D&H Canal Interpretive Center, Frederick Cook Society, Fort Delaware, Liberty Museum and Art Center, Sullivan County Historical Society, 10 Mile River Scout Museum, and the Time and the Valleys Museum. And apart from Fort Delaware, these museums are all offering free admission. And most of these museums have tours, special events, shop discounts, giveaways, and more going on for this museum weekend. So there you have it. Nine museums. Can you dig it? Let's see how many that you and I can get to, and let's report back here Monday, see how we did, all right? But for now, that's it for the local edition. I've been your host, Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Got the Daily up next. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Grizzly Bagels, small-batch handmade New York-style bagels in Roscoe, New York, grizzlybagels.com, and from listeners like you who donate at WJ.